This is an ABC podcast.
For most of us, when we talk about making sense of a situation, we're talking about a mental process. We stop and have a bit of a think, try to figure out what's going on and how we should respond. If it's a critical situation, say in a workplace environment, and we don't have time to think, we might fall back on our training, which is to say a form of sense-making that's been thought through in advance. But what if we consider making sense as an embodied process? How does it look then? And how might embodied sense-making be a better way to approach difficult or dangerous situations? That's the question we're asking in the Philosopher's Zone this week. Welcome to the program. I'm David Rutledge, and my guest this week is not your typical academic philosopher.
Hello, I'm Brad Roberts, and I'm a researcher in the area of organizational dynamics and embodied cognition. I completed my PhD through Swinburne University, and I work in the maritime safety field with the Australian Maritime Safety Authority at the moment as an industry liaison officer.
Brad Roberts's PhD research explored the ways in which seafaring master mariners and chief engineers make sense of critical events at sea. His theoretical lens for this was neurophenomenology, and we'll be getting into that a little later in the program. Brad's research method involved doing interviews and gathering first-person narrative accounts of life at sea, a life that can be pretty intense.
These master mariners and also the chief engineers lead teams that work at sea. They work 24 hours, 7 days a week for 5 weeks at a time, generally in very remote and fairly inhospitable places, such as Australia's Northwest Shelf. They work in the energy sector, working along oil and gas, but increasingly, you know, along renewable wind farms as well. And they tow and resupply offshore platforms. So it's very high stakes, high pressure, and it's a very highly regulated, highly technical sector. But at the same time, in terms of the people aspects, it's very isolated. Their world, as they describe it, shrinks down to those core things that are happening in their environment, you know, almost divorced from any of those externalities.
And how are they trained?
Oh, look, they go through very rigorous training, which is set out through some global standards. And they're taught the technical aspects of the role. They're taught how to navigate, how to maintain the vessel, and how to conduct cargo operations and towing operations. So there's a high focus on the technical, the techne of what they're learning. And there's a high focus on the regulatory side of things. It's a huge amount of the rules and the regulations and the rules of the road and so many other things. There's a bit of an absence on the actual practice and what it means from what Aristotle would call phronesis, or that practical wisdom that either gets picked up on the job or it's kind of left to a bit of chance that they pick up the ways of seafaring and what it means to be a seafaring leader.
So into this very rational, very technology-driven, highly regulated environment, you're bringing something that you refer to as embodied sense-making. Let's talk about that. What is embodied sense-making, first of all?
I think the best way to describe it is that embodied sense-making represents all the bodily and the extended, the emotional and the enacted dynamics that shape the way people, all of us, make sense of the world. And I borrowed partly from the work of Carl Weick, the organizational theorist who really pioneered that field of sense making, but he tended to frame it purely as a social and a language-based phenomena. So people in organizations talk about what's going on and they make sense of their situations. But there's a growing body of work that frames sense making in embodied terms. And so that's what I was keen to explore and extend upon. And what my research has been able to do is map the neurobiological processes that give rise to sense-making in phenomenological terms.
And it doesn't just stop at the limits of the individual body, does it? You're also talking about it as something that extends into the controls of the ship and also through other people, like the crew of the ship. Is that right?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of evidence in the narratives that they do extend themselves through the ship, through the ship's instrumentations, as part of the sensors, through the ship's dynamics, its propulsions and things like that. And they pretty much, when they talk about moving their vessel out of harm's way, they say, I just ran. They don't say, I had to move my vessel out of harm's way. They talk about it as themselves. You know, ships don't run. They don't have legs. So it's a very embodied, natural way of thinking about it. But that also extends through the crew that are largely linking through with them from a sensory point of view, but also in a motor point of view of going and doing things. And that really comes to the fore during, you know, critical events and crises that happen, which is what I've looked at.
Well, if we think of examples of how embodied sense-making can provide a better way of responding to a critical situation than strictly rational apprehension, you've written about the Piper Alpha explosion in the late 1980s. What happened there?
Yeah, look, definitely the Piper Alpha was an oil platform in the North Sea that caught fire in 1988. And it was a monumental fire that completely destroyed the structure but also prevented rescue. And that incident killed 167 people and left only 62 survivors. And whilst it prompted significant maritime improvements, it came at a real tragic cost. But what sparked my curiosity was that the 62 survivors were mostly those that were out in the open. And they were the people who felt the heat and saw the flames and the smoke. And what they did was they jumped for their lives into the North Sea. Whilst the 167 who perished, they were all primarily inside the accommodation area. And so they were largely buffered or shielded from the heat and the smoke and the flames and that embodied reality of their situation. And what those individuals did is they said, well, we'll just, you know, we'll wait for rescue. This is what we've been trying to do. So, you know, we'll wait for the helicopters to come. And unfortunately, the helicopters weren't able to come to save them. So these two groups had very different sensory experiences and made very different senses of their predicament. And in the end, in this case, that embodied sense-making meant the difference between life and death. And so that really sparked my interest in this field to pursue.
You write that this is an under-researched phenomenon in the literature of maritime human factors. Why do you think that that's the case, this relative lack of interest in embodied sense-making?
Well, I think it largely depends upon where maritime human factors has come from. And when I looked at the literature, over an 18-year period, there was only 2% focus on sense-making, but a 49% focus on the technology-based aspects of maritime operations. But look, it seems likely to be due that human factors emerged largely out of the Second World War and developed pretty rapidly over the 50s and 60s. So it consolidated itself very early in that regard, and it was largely at a time where there was a predominance of techno-rationalist mindset that tended to pursue, you know, finding single causes for things in a very reductionist way. So if they could find the part that was broken, they would say, yes, it was a mechanical fault in this part of the vessel or the aircraft. But if they couldn't, they then just put it into this large grab bag of human error. If we couldn't find anything wrong, then it must have been a person. And look, largely at that time too, whilst we were developing huge, massive developments in the computer sector. So largely, I think the mental construct for the mind was the brain as a computer. So we really had a predominance of this rational thinking process. And that by doing so, rationality would eliminate this human error.
Yeah, it sounds like in many ways the industry is still haunted by the ghost of Descartes, as we all are. You know, that very strict separation of mind and body where the rational is valorized over and above the what you might call the visceral, because the mind is where all the sense making supposedly occurs.
Yeah, look, I think definitely. And the maritime seems to be more traditional than other sectors such as the airline or the aircraft aerospace industry. And by being very traditional, it sort of subscribes to this view of the world that the mind is basically where we live and who we are. And we basically drive around the body as a vehicle that then engages with the world. So that type of thinking, and it sort of fits with that techno-rationalist reductionist view, is that the mind is separate from the body and is separate from the world. And that divide that comes from Descartes' "I think, therefore I am," puts the conscious mind very much divorced from their environment and from what's going on. And it's just really observing and interacting. So as Daniel Dennett described this, he describes it as Cartesian gravity. It's a very difficult view to escape because we're mainly aware of our conscious minds. And so our conscious thoughts and our conscious way of seeing the world is all around us. But the embodied aspect of it is often sits outside of our consciousness.
Well, you've explored the ways in which sense-making is embodied via what you call a phenomenologically attentive narrative interpretive approach. There's a lot to break down there. Let's start with the word, with that word phenomenology. What's your understanding of phenomenology and how is it informing your research here?
Look, it really is around studying the perceptions and the experiences of humans in, you know, particular streams of life. And so that was why I conducted critical in-depth interviews with the masters and the chief engineers. And I paid close attention to the phenomenological content of their stories, so their perceptions and their experiences, and continually asking them what it was like. But I also paid phenomenological attention to what they were bodily doing during the interview process and during their recollections. And the other thing I did is also sailed with them on an offshore ship. So I had the chance to live myself into their experiences and into their life world as well. So, and the other part that makes it phenomenological is that I was very disciplined in bracketing out the preconceived ideas I might have had regarding theory and explanation, and just sat with and dwelled with their stories. So I was merely recording in the initial phase and curating their stories of their lived experiences and their perceptions. And what I was aiming for was thick descriptions of their sense-making.
When we talk about lived experience and perception, I mean, there's something immediate about the phenomenological engagement with the world. It's a sensory engagement first and foremost. But is it exclusively sensory? Is there any room there for thought or reflection or analysis?
Well, look, I think there is from that regard. And there is because of the active nature of sense-making, in that people don't just passively perceive the world as it glides on past them. You know, as I said, we predictively encode for what we expect to see. And so it is more of an active role. And it also depends on what you mean by thinking as well, and whether you mean those conscious thoughts that occur to us, almost as in the form of words, or whether there is a deeper level of preconscious processes that are going on. And that deeper preconscious level is often tied with those other aspects, such as emotion and such as action and such as bodily experiences. And look, I think it was Maurice Merleau-Ponty that said in The Primacy of Perception that we install ourselves in our perceptions in order to analyze our relationships between the subject, which is ourselves, its body, which is our body, and the world. So he very much, as a phenomenologist, was of the view that it was an active thing and it was a reflective thing.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. I mean, I guess what he's getting at there, and what you're getting at, is that thought and analysis, they're kind of weasel words, because there are ways of thinking and analyzing that don't involve a rational thought process, right?
Yeah, look, and definitely one of the notions that comes forward in this is unthought knowns, you know, that's attached to things such as Bourdieu's habitus, is things that we know about. We haven't actually thought about it, but we know them. And likewise, I think Polanyi's view that there is more known than we can tell means that there is a knowledge and a knowledge level that sort of exists below that level of conscious, explicit, and often languaged thought.
You're in the Philosopher's Zone, and this week it's a nautical zone. I'm David Rutledge, and my guest is Brad Roberts, who's a liaison officer with the Australian Maritime Safety Authority. We're talking about embodied sense-making and how our rational apprehension of the world doesn't always steer us in the right direction. Okay, so we've talked about phenomenology. Where does neurophenomenology come into all this?
Well, neurophenomenology is really an attempt to achieve a nexus between first-person descriptions of experience, often in narrative terms, and third-person neuroscience. So it really is a harmonisation or a reconciliation, if you like, between these two very separate fields, one of them being particularly almost subjectivist in the way how it views the world, and the other one very much positivist. And what the pioneers in this field, such as Francisco Varela, had come to the view is that as organisms, we do make sense of things in embodied ways. So there's a neurobiological dynamic or aspect to the way we perceive the world. And there's quite a brilliant quote that kind of sums up this view. Just to share it with yourself, David, is that, and it comes from Claxton, who really describes neurophenomenology as a view of the human body as a massive, seething, streaming collection of interconnected communicating systems that bind the muscles, the stomach, the heart, the senses, and the brain so tightly together that no part, especially the brain, can be seen as functionally separate from or senior to any other part. And that's probably the best summary that I've found on that area of neurophenomenology. But look, it also includes emotions. And rather than being unwanted byproducts of events, you know, they're often seen as getting in the way of their roles. They really are the way how we and also the seafarers enact their roles. It often galvanizes actions, or it drives people to make sense of a situation. And that shows it's more than just a stimulus response model, that we actually use our emotions to actively make sense of the world and react when we don't get what we actually expected to get from the world itself.
Cactus 1539 hit birds, so you've lost thrust on both engines, returning back towards LaGuardia.
Okay, you need to return to LaGuardia. Turn left, heading up 220.
220.
Tire, stop your departure. He's got emergency returning. It's 1529. Bird strike. He lost all engine. He lost the thrust in the engines. He's returning immediately. Back is 1529. Do you want to try to land 1313?
1313. We may end up in the Hudson.
Let's turn away from seafaring for a minute and talk about the case of US Airways Flight 1549. This was not a maritime incident, but an aviation one. But I think it illustrates some of these ideas we've been talking about. Happened in January 2009. A plane had just taken off from LaGuardia Airport in New York. What happened next?
So most people know the story about Captain Sully Sullenberger and how he saved the crew and the passengers by landing on the Hudson. And it's often described as a miracle, but when you view it through an embodied sense-making lens, it actually seems quite plausible. So very shortly after the bird strike occurred, aside from all the sensors on the plane, the key triggers that he talks about for his sense-making was his own senses of sitting in the cockpit. And one of the things he recalls is the smell of burning seabirds. So that's a very embodied response to what was going on. Very early on in the radio transcript, within 30 seconds of contacting the tower to say he had a problem, he actually says, we're going to land in the river. And he doesn't say that formally, you know, as in reporting to the tower. It's almost like something he's saying to himself or a conclusion on some level that he's reaching. So what Sully did, he had his co-pilot go through a detailed technical checklist in order to restart the engine. But as it turns out, that process only works when the aircraft is at a significantly higher altitude than what they were. So the process was really never going to work for them. But he had that going, and whilst his co-pilot was going through those formal technical solutions, what he was doing was acclimatizing himself and accepting that he knows he's going to be landing this plane on the river. So when he was in the Air Force, he actually practiced belly landings. So he knew the glide path that was required, both intellectually, but also bodily. He knew what was required of that aircraft as an extension of himself when that arc met the water and what that dynamic would be. So it very much became an embodied process from that point on, an embodied sense-making process. And a lot of people have commented that he seems extremely composed throughout. So they say, well, he didn't really have an emotional response, but I would say he was not devoid of emotion. If you listen to himself on the radio, what he says is he noticed a slightly higher pitch to his voice and a raspy breath, which wasn't his normal state, but he was also completely committed to saving his people. And he was also committed in some ways to demonstrating his belief that pilots, as he says in his memoir, they used to be one step down from astronauts. He says, but increasingly the world just sees us as bus drivers. And I wonder on some level whether or not there was part of him sort of saying, well, I'm going to save all these people and I'm really going to demonstrate, you know, my chops as a pilot that we are one step down from astronauts and we are not mere bus drivers. And as Colin Betty, I think, claims in researching this, she says that affect is the absence of indifference. And that's really what she defines emotion as. And in this state, at that time, he's anything but indifferent. And so this exactly matches the accounts that the seafarers gave me. And it matches the neurophenomenology as well. And when you view it through this lens, it kind of ceases to be a miracle, but it becomes a very profound act of embodied sense-making and also practical wisdom.
On that notion, though, of the role of the emotions, I agree with you with what you're hearing in the audio from the flight recorder, that you can hear his voice change, you can hear a sort of a rasp there. But to me, it suggests not so much that he's experiencing emotions, although he obviously is, but more that he has his emotions in check. He has them under control. And you might say that while, you know, the emotions are important in certain critical situations, wouldn't it be fair to say that emotions can also really get in the way? They can affect your judgment. And if I was a passenger on that plane and I was asked to choose, do I want my pilot to be experiencing emotions or experiencing no emotions at all, I would probably opt for the latter. And it sounds to me like that could be what he's doing, is getting emotion out of the equation, if you like.
Yeah, and at the same time, I'm not certain if he's actually, when we say have our emotions under control, there are probably two ways of looking at it. One of them is to sort of say, do we have them stifled and bridled to the point where we can't express it or we can't... you know, we've essentially choked our emotions. But I think what he's done is he has actually integrated them into what he's doing. So the sense of confidence that he has, is that effect? It probably is. And did it help him? That emotional sense of commitment and resolve, which are also feelings, definitely did help him do what he was doing as well. So it is not a rational yoking of the emotions, because that takes time, that takes effort. It takes some of those other things that are necessary in terms of effect, in terms of getting the best outcomes. But it definitely is someone who didn't let their emotions become problematic. Whether that was choking them down, I think it was more an alignment because those emotions of confidence and commitment and resolve were all essential for what he was doing. If he didn't have those emotions, he would have attempted to land at a safe airfield somewhere.
Well, just finally, Brad, you're calling on the maritime sector to integrate embodied sense-making within its theoretical paradigms. It's a big ask, I would say, but how might this integration happen? You know, what might it look like in terms of training, for example?
I think one of the main things that would be beneficial is incorporating embodied sense-making in holistic terms that recognise that maritime incidents happen, you know, as a coming together of incidents, not as a single incident, that the current techno-rationalist, reductionist, you know, find the wonky bolt that caused the accident doesn't allow us to do. So number one is bringing that holistic sense into our maritime incident investigation and our thinking about it. You know, secondly, by unpacking embodied sense making for the learners, enables them to develop what Aristotle would call practical wisdom or phronesis. And that's very much a values-based approach that helps form those positive notions about their roles and as, you know, seafaring leaders. And in fact, that's actually being done at the moment via the technology that's available to us through very immersive computer simulations and of seafaring environments and ships and so forth, and bridge simulators. But it's being used by some researchers by Charlotte Selbury in Gothenburg University to train on this practical wisdom aspect of seafaring, not just the technology and the technical aspects of it as well. So that's giving a more rounded, a more prepared batch of seafaring leaders. But the other thing that we need to unpack too, and it comes from the current seafaring habitus, which, as I said, is, you know, it can be highly autocratic, it's highly infallible in the way how it sees itself, and highly autonomous. And that really doesn't connect with a more diverse and more interconnected, collaborative way of working that we have. So it would be really important to bring that seafaring habitus into conscious reflection and understand how it is shaping the identities and the way how our seafaring leaders make sense of their job and make sense of their role in critical events.
Brad Roberts, he's a liaison officer with the Australian Maritime Safety Authority in Melbourne. And that brings us to the end of the Philosopher's Zone for this week. Join me next week when we're going to be talking about the compulsive restlessness that seems to plague us all these days. You might be obsessively checking your Twitter account while you listen to me saying this. Well, next week you can find out why and what a tradition of French Enlightenment philosophy might bring to our understanding of this modern malaise. I'm David Rutledge on Twitter any old time at David P. Zone. Bye for now.